And
what'd you say?
What is this?
So I want to thank Maurice Jacobson for joining us tonight and talking about his film, We All Live in Gaza, which he's been working on for quite a long time. A couple of announcements before we start. First, I want to remind people of what's coming up. And so next in 2 weeks, we are on Monday night, we have The Present, which was an Academy Award film, a 25-minute film, which we're going to screen. And it's about a checkpoint in the West Bank. And we're going to have, we have in hand a video message from the filmmaker. 2 weeks beyond that, we have Sammy Smuha on Palestine and Jewish citizens in Israel and their identity. And we're working on things beyond that. Anyone who has suggestions, please forward them to Dick or myself. As many of you know, we give a donation, an honorarium to each speaker, and we do that out of our dues. And so our dues is now down to our bank account is down to a level where we're going to ask, or we are asking for dues contributions. The easiest way to do it is to send it to me as a banker at either PayPal or Venmo. And there's my PayPal and Venmo address. And it's these donations by donating, giving, by paying.
Jeff, you went silent.
By paying dues, you're helping to support the groups, because we give donations to the groups where the speakers come to our Zooms. Okay, so let's go back. Whoops, wrong way. That's going to be, by the way. Okay, so tonight we have Maurice Jacobson. Oh, one other thing I want to talk about, and that is, in case we get bombed, or in the odd case that Zoom cuts us off, just close your Zoom contact, wait 3 minutes, and come back in the same spot. So if we get either bombed or Zoom cuts us off for some unknown reason. Okay, so tonight we have Maurice Jacobson. We've known Maurice for about 10 years. And through all that time, he's been working on the film, We All Live in Gaza. The film will be released in a premiere in Washington, D.C. in months, weeks or months, something like that, but very soon.
Well, we'll talk about it for sure.
Okay. Anyway, the film has the same title, We All Live in Gaza. It's the same medium. It's a film. The message is really the same, that the people who live in Gaza are real people with the same needs and wants as people everywhere in the world. But Maurice's presentation and his story has grown over the past decade, and it's way richer now. Not only that, the project has expanded to include art shows that he sponsored of people who, of art made in Gaza. Maurice came to the Gaza Project after a career as a producer photographer for international A-line media companies. So he's well-versed in the videography. One last thing, Dick reminds us that we should all mute ourselves while Maurice is talking. So with that, I'll pass the floor to Maurice.
Okay, well, first of all, I really want to thank you all for inviting me and letting me talk about the project. I talked really briefly to Jeff about what he would like me to talk about. And there's basically three areas that I think would be interesting to discuss. One is the process of actually making this documentary, or actually any documentary that that one wants to produce. But this particular project has had quite a number of roadblocks and interesting hurdles that we've had to jump over as we've gone through the process of making it. And then we wanted to talk a little bit about the distribution, which is going to be a real challenge in and of itself. After one finishes a documentary about a controversial subject, especially one as controversial as Israel-Palestine is, we've got some interesting challenges to get it out into the world. And then I've been in contact on a pretty regular basis over the last months with people in Gaza. So I have a fairly good feeling of what's going on inside the territory now. And I can share a little bit with you. But as we go through the evening, please, I'm much more comfortable and much happier answering questions than just kind of spewing forth myself. But I guess the first question I have is I'd like to show a video that I suggested that maybe some of you watch that was shot in Gaza the day of the when the shelling ended. And it's a pretty interesting glimpse of the reality of life inside Gaza. So I guess my question is, should I show that again now and we could talk about it, or have people seen it? Can I get a feedback a little bit?
Why don't you go ahead and show it, or at least part?
Yeah, it's only three minutes. So I'm going to, I've got the screen share ready to go. And so I'm going to play this 3 minute video, 3.5 minute video, because it kind of gives a sense of Gaza today. I mean, really, literally today. So here we go. Do we see the screen now?
Not yet.
Thank you.
So you can get a little bit of a sense that, you know, Gaza is not all death and destruction, and the people there are just incredibly resilient. And I found it pretty unusual myself to see so many people at the beach. And to, that was literally the day after the shelling ended, that people were out and about. And those first scenes at night were in the middle of the night, because the shelling ended about 2 a.m. and people were out in the street immediately. So I've been asking the artists and Rami Issa and his father, who run the company, the Media Group, what life is like. And by the way, I think I might have written this, and some of you might have seen it in a blog or the newsletter that we sent out, but our media partner, the Media Group, their offices were in the building complex, the same building complex as Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. So they did, in fact, lose a lot of their equipment. They had a three-camera studio that they used to do broadcasts, and that was all lost. So we did a crowdsourcing campaign about 2 months ago, and some of you contributed and helped with that. So thank you again for those of you from LA Jews for Peace who helped, because it's been tremendous assistance moving along. But some of the money that we raised, we bought a nice camera package to help replace one of the cameras that they lost there. And now, literally today, I was trying to sort out how to get that camera package into Gaza. And none of the companies, DHL or FedEx or UPS, none of the major companies are shipping into Gaza. And so we found a forwarding company in Ramallah. And I went to the post office today to use international shipping to send the camera package to Ramallah. And unfortunately, the post office doesn't even have Palestine listed as a country or as a destination. They said, well, you can send it to Israel. And I said, well, yes, but if it gets to Israel, how is it going to get to the West Bank? And none of the clerks at the main post office here in Kansas City could answer that. So I still got the camera package sitting on in the office right behind me here. And I'm still not quite sure 100% how we're going to get that material to the Media Group. And also for the four artists who we've been working with and a little bit of backup, I think I should, if some of you have been following the projects that will know this, others of you probably may not. But in the documentary, we feature two artists. Hold on, I got a phone call, but I'm gonna let it go through, and forgive me if it's ringing here. I'll call them back. So the two artists that we have featured are Malik Matter and Basil Marcuzzi, who you meet in the documentary. And if we have time, I can play a little clip from them. And they're really a focal point of the documentary now. And the reason why, and you can see some of the artwork that's hanging on the wall of our studio here behind us, is that one of the difficulties of talking to people about media or talking to people about Israel-Palestine is to address an audience that's not already knowledgeable or susceptible, not susceptible isn't the right word, but already acknowledgeable and supportive of the issues. How do we get to an audience that is either skeptical or not aware or just is feels overwhelmed with all the media that they have around them? How do we get to these people? And one method is kind of like a Trojan horse we think about, is to bring people to an art show, an art gallery of Middle Eastern art. And if they come to see the art, then we can raise a lot of the issues that the artists are facing in Gaza, which are the same issues that anyone living in Gaza are facing. But it's a very good way of kind of cracking the door open so that people see this world-class art. And it really, truly is world-class art. It can really stand on its own anywhere. And then learn the story of these individual artists. Basil Marcuzzi lost his home. It was bombed. And actually, he lost it through collateral damage. The house next to his was bombed, and then that house collapsed on his, and he lost a good deal of his artwork in the process. But out of that came a very, very strong series of work that he calls Art Insane, that he did just in black and white. And it's one of the strongest series that I think we've been trying to show. So the art is an integral part of the We All Live in Gaza project. So do any of you have any questions that I could answer at this point about the making of the documentary or about the motivation or anything specifically that I could address, or should I just kind of ramble on and talk about the history of the project?
Daryl. You're all unmuted.
Yeah, thank you, Maurice. How often and how recently and to what extent have you been in Gaza itself?
Well, I've been there twice. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get in a third time and couldn't get in. But the last time I was there was after the 2014 bombings. I was there in 2015. And I tried to get in 2 years ago. I was actually invited, had an invitation by the, another phone call, but we'll put it aside for a while. I was invited by the Mental Health Association inside Gaza to make a presentation about the media work, and flew into to Tel Aviv and went immediately to the Arab border. But then I wasn't allowed in. And I went to, I then did what I did the first two times I went in, which was going through Egypt, through the Rafah crossing.
Yeah.
And at that particular moment in history, the border was closed. As probably most of you know, the border between Egypt and Gaza is very sporadic. So when I went to Egypt, the border was closed, and I just couldn't wait the 2 or 3 months that I did the first time I went in Rafah to try to get in. But with Zoom and with, you know, communications the way it is now, I feel like I've been able to get into the country fairly often because I'm in pretty regular contact with the crew there. and they've been shooting on a fairly regular basis. So what the latest issue or the latest version of the documentary is really, it's almost an epic, because there's footage from 2009 all the way through last week. And so the edit that we're working on will be pretty substantially different than edits that we've shown over the years. And I had a chance to show it a couple of times in LA, the work in progress. But the whole mission of the documentary really hasn't changed. And it's to really just giving, well, it has changed. I have to back that up. After I came out of Gaza in 2015, the last time I was there, I edited a 90-minute edit. And the whole 90-minute edit was inside Gaza. It was profiles of nine different families there. Farmer, some of the artists, the mayor of Rafah, a single mother. And we did a whole series of screenings in the UK and Ireland that were organized by the solidarity campaigns in those countries. And the feedback that I got was, well, you know, this is a really nice documentary and it's really great to see all these people, but the documentary raised more questions than it answered. And the big question that everybody asked in those screenings was, how does the world community allow Gaza to continue? That people, you know, that it's ignored so much, except for when there's bombing. And I couldn't answer that. I mean, I had no real answer for that. And so I was able to get another small amount of funding, just enough to cover expenses. And I went to try to find the answer. So I spent a fair amount of time in Israel, in Jerusalem. And I went to I wanted to understand the Holocaust and the effect of the Holocaust on policy in Israel. So I went to Warsaw and I went to Auschwitz and I went to Terezin. Went to Berlin to the wall to understand that. So now the documentary really is half in Gaza and half out of Gaza, talking to people about kind of not an answer so much of how to end the conflict, but to try to understand why the conflict is continuing unabated. And also in the documentary, and this has been problematic, and as a media maker and as I'd like to think of myself as a journalist rather than an activist, but as a journalist, it's important to tell the story. So in the documentary, there's probably 5 or 6 minutes of members of Hamas, including Mahmoud Zahar, who was one of the founders of Hamas. And this has caused a lot of problems along the line, because two of the people or two of the organizations who have been helping the project and who have been fairly supportive over the years, both withdrew their support totally, saying that if we can't have anything to do with a film that has Hamas in it, because we may lose our tax exempt status. And so this was a kind of a moral, ethical question. Do I keep Hamas in or do I keep the support of these groups? And I kept Hamas in. And that was a little bit of a setback, but I think it makes the program stronger, because it's very hard to do a documentary about Gaza without talking about Hamas, which is an integral part of life in Gaza. There's no question about that. And when people ask me about Hamas, my answer is basically what I think is true, that there are actually three Hamases. And it's hard to separate them, but they are very distinct in their role and perception. There's the political Hamas, which is very much like any political party anywhere. Their whole raison d'etre is to stay in power as a political entity. And then there's the bureaucratic Hamas, which are the men and women who run the hospitals and run not all the schools, because UNRWA runs a good part of the schools, but they run the schools that are not UNRWA schools, and they're responsible for, you know, street cleaning and policing. And that bureaucratic Hamas really seems to have a lot of respect, because they're working under incredibly difficult situations, obviously because of the siege and the lack of resources that they have. And then the third Hamas is the military militias. And they pretty much, it's very hard to know as an outsider how much connection there is between those other two elements and the militias. But I can say that most of the militias are young people who would be considered, you know, without sounding pejorative, but they're kind of the working class Hamas. They're the guys who, you know, haven't gone on to university. And, you know, again, it surprises people when I tell people that there are 7 universities in Gaza, and a very, very large percentage of young people go to universities, especially the women. And they take education very seriously. And one of the benefits that I had when I was there is that it's a requirement of not all the universities, but the 4 major universities, that graduates have an English proficiency. So it seemed like most of the people that I hung out with when I was in Gaza were young people, and they were very helpful in helping to translate. But most of the young people and you know, the older people my age, did not speak English, but a good part of the young people did. But to go back to the militias, they are, and we can't deny the fact and that they are getting a lot of support externally from Iran and from Syria and from Hezbollah. And that encourages them, because they are, again, I can't say how they're getting there, the arms that they're getting, but they are getting them. And there's a pretty strong underground network, which is getting arms and ammunition into Gaza. But it's all coming from external sources primarily. And that kind of fuels the ongoing dynamic and where the stalemate, although today, if you all read Haaretz, which is pretty much a daily read for me, is that some breakthroughs seem to be happening, that there's a representative from Qatar there today who's delivering a fairly substantial amount of aid to Gaza, and the Qatar government is working with Egypt to negotiate more of an opening of construction materials going in. So physically, people in Gaza are surviving. They're real survivors, as I'm sure all of you get a sense of that. But a lot of the young people, especially the ones who have gone to university and have, you know, a good education, and who have the opportunity to apply for graduate scholarships outside of Gaza. The border is completely hermetically sealed now. And they're having a really depressing time being able to leave. It's a combination of the pandemic, but also the politics. But anyway, that's a very long answer to the last time I was in Gaza, but I do feel fairly connected to it as best I can.
Let me ask a follow-on, Maurice. You said there are three parts of Hamas, which I fully agree with. It's the political and the military and the civil servants. Well, who right. pays the civil servants? Are they paid by the political or the military?
They're actually, for many, many years, they were actually being paid by the through Ramallah, through the PA. And then when Mahmoud Abbas wanted to put more pressure on Hamas to give more power to Fatah, which is, you know, part of the dilemma as well. Right now, the civil service people are getting paid by external money, primarily for many years, it was coming from Qatar, who was putting money in. Some money was coming from the US up until 2 years ago when Trump cut that off. So the civil service are living on about a third or a half of what their salaries should be. But what's interesting about Gaza is that because everybody is in the same position, it's like people understand if people don't have money or can only pay half their rent, that people accept it. So it's a real combination, really, Jeff, on how they're getting paid. But a lot of that money is coming through the Ramallah. So it has been. And now it's coming, right now, as of today, coming from Qatar.
Maurice, my question is about the flow of information in and out. You said you're on Zoom all the time. How easy is it for people in Gaza to get access to the outside world electronically? And then how many of them actually take advantage of it? Like in the United States, we have no problem getting access, but not too many people would ever take advantage of it.
Right. Well, one thing that is true in Gaza is that there isn't any internet censorship. And so people have free access to the internet without any sites being blocked. Almost all young people have computers, have laptops. The big problem is not so much the internet, which amazingly to me was up and running during all the bombings over in May, but the big problem is power, because power is still only on for 4 to 6 hours a day. And people don't know, it's not like a regular time from 11 till 3 in the afternoon it's on. People don't know when it's going to be on. So there's this mad rush, whether it's 6 in the morning or 11 at night, when the power comes back on for everybody to charge their electronic stuff. But my experience has been, at least with the people that I've been in contact with, that they have access to the internet, and Zoom works pretty well, and WhatsApp works perfectly. I've never had any trouble making a WhatsApp call. The local service is called PALNET, which is actually a West Bank company. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think a lot of the towers aren't in Gaza itself. A lot of the towers are right at the border that PALNET pays Israel to install the cell towers so that when there's bombing, the cell service seems to be pretty consistent and stay on. So yeah, that hasn't really been too much of an issue.
We heard that during the last attacks by Israel, a lot of people were using TikTok and a lot of other social media to get pictures and photographs and video of what was actually happening on the ground out of Gaza to the world, and that they couldn't depend on the corporate media, so they basically depended on social media, and it was very effective.
Yeah, no, people are using that all the time, and from what I understand, press was banned from entering Gaza during the 11 days. So even a crew from The Guardian or some of the more progressive international publications couldn't get in. I was amazed that, I'm not sure whether any of you saw it, but I was watching Al Jazeera a fair amount during the 11 days, and they were back running within a half hour after the tower went down. Apparently they went over to a French television, Agence France Presse, whose facility was still up. And then the media group, the group that I've been working with, although they lost their building, they have a mobile truck with an uplink, and they were doing the uplinks for the BBC. So there was some media getting out, but I don't think any of the media was coming to America. It was mostly a lot of European media was there, or trying to be there.
I don't want to hog it. Did Yossi? Did you have your hand up? Yossi's muted, but what the
hell? In the last whatever year or two, I was all the time thinking, so here is you have a situation. The Israeli government have no intention to lift the blockade. Hamas have very few friends in the world. It's a stalemate of a vicious cycle that go to nowhere, on and on and on. And the Western countries, even those who have been disliked Netanyahu in the past, more or less gave him a free hand there, because they look at him as one of us, the West, versus the bad guys. This is how they say that, even if he's not very nice, but he's one of us. So I just wondering, sometime you see the situation and you ask yourself, what is the strategy of thinking to break this stalemate inside Gaza among people who are associated with Hamas or people who are not, because Hamas is the power broker in Gaza. They control the army, they control the bureaucracy, but I don't see anything from them initiating something that maybe can make a breakthrough, at least, or at least in any attempt, like the PLO did in 1988 when they accepted resolution 242 and they opened the gate to the world community.
Well, here's my take on it. And I mean, sometimes we can be very pessimistic about it, but part of the dynamic is that although Hamas is very conservative religiously, they are pragmatic, and they do understand that Israel in reality is not going to go away. There's never going to be a Palestinian state per se, but they feel isolated. No one in the international community is willing to talk to them directly. If the United States or the European Union was willing to sit down and treat them as equals and treat them as a viable political entity, then discussions could take place to try to find incremental ways to end the siege, end the blockade, provide commerce and industry. And from my experience as a journalist, I spent two or three or four years in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, covering that situation for public television. And what eased the tensions there was when the European Union started putting tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into the infrastructure in Northern Ireland, and everybody started working. And when everybody was working, no matter what side they were on, they were so busy trying to, you know, raise enough money to buy a new BMW and to have a good life that they forgot about the issues that got them pissed off in the first place. And so the dynamic, although it's not perfect in Northern Ireland, there hasn't been any fighting for many, many years, and the economies are fairly decent. So if the West started treating Hamas as a real entity instead of a pariah, then I think things could start improving. And the other side of the coin of that, I think it's very, very important. And what groups like LA Jews for Peace are important, and all the other support groups, is we have to change American public opinion. Because if America starts putting pressure on Israel by saying, okay, we're gonna hold back on loan guarantees, we're gonna start holding back on the money we're giving you militarily, we're going to start putting more pressure on you to make a political settlement, that Israel is going to have to respond, because they do rely a great deal on the US. There is no question that we are a key element. And it's like a paradigm shift that I think has to happen in America. It's like a paradigm shift in terms of any one of the big social movements in the country. If we would have said 10 years ago that marijuana was going to be legalized, people would have said, you're crazy, that'll never happen. The same with gay marriage, the same to a certain degree with our support of South Africa. And the paradigm shift is when 50% of the population supports an issue. If we get to 50% of the population in America saying, yeah, the Palestinians are getting screwed. Israel is an apartheid state, which they most clearly are. And it's been great that groups like Human Rights Watch has declared them an apartheid state in a really strong statement. That once I think we get to 50% of the population understanding the Palestinian perspective, that paradigm shift is going to happen very fast. And when that paradigm shift happens very fast, when people start understanding how badly the Palestinians have been treated over the years, then I think we might get a policy change in the US. I might be naive and I might be overly optimistic, but I don't think that that's an unrealistic way to look at it. I mean, what do you think, Ilse?
I tell you something. I remember that until 1988, it was a stalemate between PLO and Israel, and the West and the PLO. And there were a lot of discussion in the PLO. What are we going to do? We can condemn, raise all those rhetoric, but we have to take the initiative on something to break the stalemate. So they came out and they accepted resolution 242. You're aware about this. Yeah. The Palestinian National Council in 1988 accepted, and this has opened the gate to talk to the West. Of course, a lot of stuff happening since then, the failure of Oslo Accord and more settlements. But I ask myself, Hamas have friends only in Iran, Syria, I don't know how much in Syria, because they left Syria because they are being critical with Assad. So I'm not even sure they have some friends there.
Yeah.
But Syrian regime is so busy with their own internal problem with the civil war. But and Hezbollah is, I don't know exactly what they're doing. One thing I know for sure, that when the Israeli army, the Air Force, was bombing Gaza, Hezbollah was silent. And I can understand why they didn't want to be involved in the war. My point is, when you are in a stalemate for so many years, maybe you make some move that can open the gate to the West, because the public opinion about Palestinians changed a little bit when the PLO accepted 242, there was an opening.
No, I don't disagree.
So I ask myself, what Hamas have to lose? What Hamas have to lose if they will accept it also 242 and said, okay, this is the reality. Now we can open dialogue. The Israeli government will react, oh, it's nothing, you know, but you at least do a move, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree
the
with
stalemate,
that.
The stalemate is a disaster for the, you know, I read some article in Israeli press, I don't know how much is true or not, about the public opinion in Gaza, where a big number of young people, their number one wish is actually to leave Gaza to a normal life.
Oh yeah, exactly. You're
because they don't have
enough. Right.
So what is the responsibility of the political leadership, which is Hamas, to say, okay, we're gonna do a bold move and see how the world will react? Because what they have to lose? Otherwise, what is the vision for the future?
You know, part of the dynamic is that I don't know who Hamas talks to for advice. You know, if you or other people could communicate with Hamas and tell them exactly what you're saying now, and they hear it from enough people, maybe they would respond. They're very insular, at least that's my experience been. I don't know how much they talk to other people, except they talk among themselves. So you're right. I mean, they have to make a move. And when I was there, I actually suggested I had a chance to have a number of conversations with Mahmoud Zahar, who speaks English. And I asked him exactly what you just said. I said, look, why don't you hold a press conference, an international Zoom press conference, and state Hamas's position and state that you're open and willing and able to have dialogue to try to find a solution. But they didn't want to hear that. And I don't know why. You know, I don't have an answer.
Yeah, if I can add something, which is might sound strange, but more I read the thinking of the Israeli leaders or the political leader, including the new government, they actually want the Hamas to stay in power forever, which will have the excuse not to do anything, but to continue to blockade. This is why they allow Qatar to bring money to Gaza, because they didn't want the things to boil too much so they can pay the salary of, I'm not exactly sure what, because you mentioned that some of the money come from the Palestinian Authority, but the money from Qatar, I don't know, $30 million a month, it's been accepted by Israel, and they want the Hamas to continue to rule Gaza so they can continue to blockade, and they want the split between the Fatah and Hamas to stay forever.
No, yeah, but...
So they have interest to keep Hamas in power. This is the
they do. In the documentary, we did an interview with Gideon Levy from Haaretz, and I asked him exactly that question. I said, what does Israel want? What's the end game? And he said, you know, I've been covering this for 20 years, and Israel does not address that, what they want, other than containment, exactly what you were just saying. But we know, as you know, anyone who studies history or understands human nature, that one society can't keep another society under suppression and occupation forever without committing genocide. And to a certain degree, Israel is doing a certain form of political genocide, and they're not taking people out and shooting them against the wall, but they're killing their spirits. They're killing their desire to do anything internally. That's what you're saying. I bet, you know, 75 or 80% of the young people that I know in Gaza would leave in the drop of a hat if they had a chance to get out of there.
David Mandel has his hand up.
Okay.
Okay. Hi. I'm in multitasking cooking here while I'm listening and watching, so I get my video off. Thanks, Maurice. And we watched the current edition of the current version of the film the other night. A lot of good stuff in there. I just wanted to, I was responding to what Yossi just said. Yossi, I think you kind of answered your own question, which is that Hamas saw what happened after PLO made its declarations in 1988 and accepted 242, et cetera, and got a lot of, for a few years, got a lot of better connection with European and other in the US, European powers in the US, and that led to Oslo, but everybody saw what happened there. I mean, basically, Israel, I mean, whether it would have been any different if Rabin had not been assassinated, some people think so, I'm skeptical, but Israel basically continued with the same outlook, which is to try to hold on to, you know, be flexible depending on, you know, where the pressures come from, but to hold on to as much territory as possible and to try to get rid of as many Palestinian people as possible. And they do that in various ways. They do it in response to the different situations on the ground in whatever ways they can. And certainly Hamas saw that, and to expect that Hamas now is going to follow the path that the PLO took in 1988 is kind of out of the question as far as I'm concerned. The Palestinian public is also, you know, totally disillusioned by that path. Not that there's been any other path that's led to a better solution, but the fact that the people, from what I read on the ground in Gaza and in the West Bank, are just fine with the fact that Hamas, you know, even with the primitive rockets that it was able to do, and the possibility that that too is a war crime, that was the only deterrent that existed that they have for Israel, aside from continuing to try to slowly build international public opinion, which is happening, but it's a very, very slow process. So I think you kind of answered your own questions. Why would Hamas want to follow that path when it really led nowhere and made the situation, if anything, even worse?
Let Yossi answer, and then let's go on to more about the film rather than...
Okay, my point is, you also look in history and you said, okay, I can learn from previous mistakes, that you have to separate between what happened in 1988 and also the Oslo Accord. Nobody can predict it, even those who started, that the Oslo Accord basically gonna die. They just decide to go this way because they realize they don't have any other alternative.
Except Edward Said.
Well, you know, they needed to open the gate. They needed to open the gate, sorry, to the world community. What accepting 242 or being more realistic with the reality, with what's happening, it does not mean that you have to go for Oslo number two. This is one thing, because he said, okay, this path end up in nowhere. But you cannot just sit in your bunkers and forever and raise rhetoric that does not build friends. You have to create friends. And sometimes you have to be more flexible in order to do it, because you have the disadvantage in this conflict. You see, this is my argument. And you can look in different conflict resolutions that took place when ANC in South Africa start negotiating with the government of South Africa. They also been realistic. What can they achieve and what they cannot be achieved? Some people call them traitors, but eventually they got to abolish apartheid through those negotiations and all other factors that took place, but they became very pragmatic in order to get there. So this is my argument, to say, oh, I'm gonna sit on in my bunkers and said, I'm the victim. And a few of us, like us in this group, will show sympathy and condemn Israel, it doesn't produce anything.
Well, just to wrap that.
My argument that this is my answer to this, that I believe sometime in you in a stalemate, you have to take some initiative and figure out what can you do, because we see it just right now, nothing happening.
You know, the dynamic, and I don't disagree with that, but one piece of sense that I do get talking to people in Gaza, when I ask them that very question that you raised, is that they feel politically that Hamas feels like being strong, being the one voice that's standing up to Israel, that people respect that, and that they feel that it's a political point internally. It's not making life better, but you saw that piece of video with hundreds and thousands of people on the streets when the bombing stopped, you know, cheering and yelling and dancing, and a lot of those people felt very positive towards the actions that Hamas took, because they were defending the rights of the Palestinians and they were defending what was happening in East Jerusalem. And so politically, I think Hamas feels like they're gaining some political points. Not that that's good, but that's just the political reality that I think is true on the ground. But I think, you know, we've gone on, we're talking about politics a little bit. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the challenges of trying to change public opinion and getting this documentary out to the world?
Yeah, that would be great, though I have a comment about this politics. But let's go back to the film and talk about where it's going from here, and maybe show us a little bit of it and so on.
Okay, well, back to the dynamics of the film is that we are totally on track for finishing all the technical elements and getting all the rights clearances and everything that one needs to do to finish the documentary and get it ready for professional distribution. And professional distribution being into film festivals and theatrical release. Now, there's some ideas that we have, one of which would be a fairly major activity that will really need the support of dozens of Palestinian support groups around the world. But there is a number of companies that specialize in what's called theatrical special events. And the company that does Live from Lincoln Center and that does a number of these one-off theatrical events of a stage performance, they also do special film screenings. So one of the things that we, and when I say we, it's just this tiny little group of people who have been making the film. What we've been talking about is doing one of these theatrical special events. So we approached the company that does Live from Lincoln Center. It's called Fathom Events. And they said that they can arrange, now that the pandemic is over, up to 300 to 400 theaters around the world who would simultaneously show the documentary. And what they do then is they split the revenues. They take 60%, but the production group gets 40%. And the numbers are pretty impressive. If there is 100 people at each screening. So one of the things that we'd love to do is to have Fathom accept the documentary. And one of the perks that we want to bring to the documentary is to have an A celebrity host who would introduce the documentary and who would lend their support, or not so much financial support, but lend their credibility to the project. So in the publicity for it, that we would have X star introducing the project. And then at the end of the documentary, have a time when people in audiences all around the country, or in every English speaking country, because we could distribute it to Ireland and UK and Australia and other countries as well, be able to ask questions of people in Gaza. Now, one thing that, you know, would be very interesting, as Yossi brought out, is to have, well, if we do that, do we just have, you know, one or two of the three of the people who are in the documentary answering questions, or do we try, and I don't know what success we might have, to get one of the political leaders of Hamas there to answer questions and maybe make a statement. I mean, it kind of is a very interesting challenge. So that's one of the things we're thinking about, the distribution. The other thing that we're thinking of doing, I'm not thinking of doing, but we're actually going to do, is we're going to enter the film into every Jewish film festival that exists anywhere on the planet. And it'll be very interesting to see what kind of response we get from these organizing committees, because there's a big Jewish film festival in San Francisco. There's one in Boston. There's one in New York. There's a big week-long Jewish film festival in London. So we're going to enter into all of those film festivals and see what kind of response we get. The other thing we want to do, and I'll show you this little image that we came up with as a rendering, if I can find it here, to do a screening on the mall in Washington, D.C. And this is going to be a real challenge to try to pull off, but it may not be impossible. I'll show you the rendering of what we want to do, but the idea would be to have a giant screen. Let me just really see. I want to see where I can find it really quickly. Here it is. Okay, I've got it. And let me just show you this real quick. So let's see, I got the screen save and share. So this this is a rendering of doing a projection on the mall in Washington, D.C. with the screen facing the Capitol. And I'm going to go to Washington in 2 weeks and start the process of getting the permits and trying to get sponsorship, financially great, but if not, just support from groups like Human Rights Watch or American Friends Service Committee, who would help sponsor and promote the event in Washington. And if we can do that, I think we can generate a fair amount of publicity and also could kickstart that idea for a theatrical special event. So those are two avenues that we want to try to explore, actually three areas, the Jewish film festivals, the screening in Washington, and then parallel to the screening in Washington, we want to do a exhibition of the artwork from the four artists that we're working with. So let me show you a rendering too of the, this is a rendering of a kiosk that we'd like to construct that could live outside on the mall during the film screening and maybe stay on the mall or other locations around the Capitol, because there's, as I'm sure you all know, there's a lot of parks and public areas around, or actually get it in the concourse at Union Station, who does art displays in the big concourse at Union Station. So this is something else we want to do, kind of using art as a Trojan horse, again, to raise people's consciousness about who lives in Gaza and try to break down so many myths and stereotypes that people have about Gaza. I mean, there's so many people just think, you know, they hear the word Palestinian, they automatically attach terrorists onto that word. So trying to use art and the kiosk. And so one thing I want to plant a seed with you guys in LA is once we have these kiosks built, and the good news is we did get a little grant of money from just an individual who has been following the project, who is going to help fund the money to build these kiosks to find locations in LA where we could put them up. It would be great to think about whether we could do them on the Santa Monica Pier or some public space in LA, but you know, it wouldn't be for another 6 or 9 months, but if you guys could maybe think about places where these guys could live, that would be great. So those are some of the things, some of the creative ways of thinking of trying to move forward with the distribution of the documentary.
I think we could think up places where to put the kiosks. But I was thinking, Maurice, maybe you would want to talk about the film. How long is the film? What's this? You said it's about four people or three people, and it goes okay. All around the world. So why don't you talk some more about what the film is really like?
Okay, well, Let me show you one thing. It's kind of like, you know, they joke that people shouldn't talk about how legislation is made, that, you know, it's like you shouldn't see the sausages being made. But what I want to show you, this is a new opening of the documentary, which I literally have finished editing 2 days ago. And the idea for this opening is based on the notion that the situation in Gaza has been going on for a very long time. And like Yossi is saying, we're in a stalemate, and that stalemate has existed for a very long time. So one of the segments in the documentary, if any of you watched that little preview that I had posted on Vimeo, is that there's a section with Ash Molloy, who's an actress that played the role of Rachel Corrie in the one-woman show, My Name is Rachel Corrie. And Ash is a wonderful actress. And so she's agreed to do the intro to the documentary talking about what Rachel Corrie wrote 22 years ago could have been written yesterday. So I used Jamie, my friend here, to do the narration of what Ash is going to do. I'm going to New York on my trip to Washington to record with Ash. But this is kind of like how sausage is made. And this is like the first, it's only two and a half minutes long, but this is like the very first sketch. So when you see the final documentary in 2 or 3 or 4 months, you'll remember what the scratch track looks like and how rough it was compared to what the final version is going to be when actually is performing. So let me just show you this. It's kind of like a rough work in progress. So you can see part of the process of how we actually pull this off. So let me just go here and go back to share screen and go to the screen, go to share, and then pull up the, and what you're seeing is it's got the name Pound 5. That's because it's stock footage. We haven't cleared the rights to use the footage yet. But you'll get it's only 2.5 minutes, but you'll get a sense of the process.
As an American with a U.S. passport, I could easily board a plane to Israel. But if I was a Palestinian girl with a Palestinian passport, there is no way I could board that same Israeli-bound flight. Indeed, there's little chance I would be able to enter the United States. For the women, men, and children of the Gaza Strip, they are literally locked inside a tiny geographic piece of planet Earth. They are under a military, economic, and political siege imposed by the State of Israel. 20 years ago, a young college student, Rachel Corrie, volunteered to enter Gaza to help in whatever way she could and to witness conditions on the ground.
The time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed every few days, if not every day. Houses are demolished here.
Not long after she arrived, she lost her life, run down by an Israeli bulldozer while protecting the home of a local woman. Her story lives on in a dramatization taken from the diaries she kept. For many years, I have taken on Rachel's persona in a one-woman performance. And the sad reality is that the words she wrote over 20 years ago could have been written yesterday.
I've been in Palestine for 2 weeks and 1 hour now. And I still have very few words to describe what I've seen here. Nothing could have prepared me for the reality of the situation. I mean, you just cannot imagine it unless you see it.
Mind the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down.
So that's a definite work in progress, but you can kind of see the direction that we want to try to go with the project. So it's a delicate balance between coming on really heavily and trying to do a message that an audience that may be skeptical of the situation or may be hostile towards Palestinians because of all the misinformation and disinformation. So we're trying to, I don't know, and you guys can give me some feedback, whether we're too soft, you know, in what we're trying to do. But the idea is to talk to the audience, is to try to have them relate in their own personal life about what it would be like to be a Palestinian, or what it would be like to be inside the siege, and to not be able to travel, to have limited access to electricity, to have limited access to being able to travel, which is the worst for most of these people, that they feel completely locked in. And Jad Ging, who is a wonderful administrator of UNRWA for many years and was a really a great spokesperson for the cause, said he didn't like calling them prisoners because, you know, prisoners didn't do it, you know, they didn't do anything wrong in Gaza. You know, they were just, this siege was imposed upon them. But they are locked inside. There's no question about that. And one of the characters in our documentary, if any of you remember him, and he's still going to be featured, is Mohammed Obed, who was a farmer. And back in 2009, he lived in the village Isbed Abet Rabo. And Isbed Abet Rabo is the first village you get to after you pass the Eretz crossing. It's you can almost see the crossing from the village. But the entire village was leveled. And it wasn't leveled by artillery shells, it was leveled with bulldozers. And it was leveled because Israel wanted a clear line of sight into Gaza. And that, so this whole farming village was destroyed. I mean, literally leveled to the ground. And there's stark footage that the media group shot that's in the documentary of the village. But anyway, as part of the epilogue that we're also shooting for the documentary, is that we are going to do after the documentary ends, or interspersed with the end credits, but we want people talking about their experiences in May of this year. And so we were going back to the characters, the main characters in the documentary. And Mohammed and his family were part of that, but we just learned that Mohammed passed away, and he passed away not because of any of the military actions, but he passed away from a cancer. And he was not allowed to leave to get the radiation treatment that he needed for the cancer that he had. So he passed away, and that actually then is good, can become part of the story in and of itself on how people with medical conditions, serious chronic medical conditions, find it difficult, if not impossible, to leave. So the answer part of Jeff's story is the documentary is made up of a dozen chapters. And each chapter tries to tell part of the story. And an important part of the story, and one of the things we're working on now, is a history of Gaza from biblical times to May 2021. And right now in the documentary, it's fairly simple. I mean, the narration, people seem to think, holds together pretty well. But part of the editing process is to do a whole series of organic montages using historical footage and small little bits of film clips to redo the animation. So we'll have a 10-minute section of the history of Gaza starting in 2000 BC till today. And I think that'll be an important context for people to understand why Gaza exists today. Because as I'm sure all of you who follow it know, that Gaza, the land of Gaza, has been under occupation for millennia. I mean, it was either Egypt or Rome. France occupied the land of Gaza for a number of years under Napoleon Bonaparte. After Napoleon Bonaparte, it was the Ottoman Empire, which was there for 180 years. Then World War I happened, the Ottoman Empire fell, the whole region was carved up. Britain took over as the British Mandate. So Gaza never had a chance to become a nation state. And I think that's very, very important for people to know that it's not just Israel that's been occupying them, but that land has been occupied for centuries. And that's part of the historical dynamic of why Gaza is what it is today. And it's important for people to know too, that the borders of Gaza are not borders. They're just an arbitrary armistice line that was developed by the UN back in 1949. And so it's important for people to understand the geopolitical history of Gaza. So that's one of the things that I think is important to do. And some of you might know the name Alex Awad. And Alex is a Palestinian. He lives in America. He teaches in America now. But he was born, he's in his 70s, was born during the Ottoman Empire. And can speak to the fact that he has both a Jordanian passport and an American passport now, because he was able to immigrate to the States. But he talks very vividly about his experiences. And I'm sure a lot of you know Jonathan Cook, the writer and author who lives in Nazareth, who's married to a Palestinian, who writes extensively about Israel-Palestine. And he talks a lot about the recent history of the area, and the fact that Britain helped Israel become what it is today. So there's a lot of background in the documentary that I think is important for people to understand. And all we're trying to do is just raise people's consciousness about who lives in Gaza, why Gaza exists, and to try to change people's opinions so that they'll understand when they hear the word Palestinian, that these folks could be their neighbors. They could be their great neighbors because the Palestinian culture and customs are so opened and welcoming. And the year and a half or 2 years I spent in Gaza, not once did I feel threatened. I was invited to dinner, you know, often. And, you know, people wanted to talk, you know, about the situation. They wanted to communicate what's going on to them. There's no real racism towards the Jewish population, but unfortunately, that's not the case the other way around. I mean, there's an awful lot of racism in Israel itself, and that's part of the problem too. But you know, if all things being equal, I think the Palestinians just want to do business with the Israelis. They don't want to fight them. And you know, we have to let the world kind of understand that. I don't know, I'm kind of proselytizing here to you guys, but that's kind of the raison d'etre for doing this documentary. Any other questions or anything that, you know, that I brought up, or any ideas that you guys might have?
I think the last point you made is important because on Facebook, I've kind of been popping in on some of these Israel-Palestinian dialogue groups. There's a lot of them on Facebook. And the people who are the Israelis are very racist, and they're all Hasbara types. I mean, you wouldn't know of the Amira Hasses and the Gidon Levies and B'Tselem. I mean, this is a world they don't even know about, they don't represent. So you have well-meaning Palestinians, and then they come up with these, you're responsible for it. You're either Israel haters or Jew haters, or you have made a mess and now you have to live in it. And yeah. If there's any, I mean, I think it's very good if you can make some rebuttal of these Hasbara points in the documentary.
No, I hope we can. I don't know whether it's possible or not, but you know, the Cinematheque in both Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, they're fairly open, and I wouldn't say liberal, but they're not closed. And it would be wonderful to have a run in those theaters, which are beautiful theaters in both the cities. Yeah. So we'll try to do that. There is a section in the documentary where we use and counter some of the Hasbara, especially during the Great March and Return, where Israel was trying to portray all the people at the demonstration as just being tools of Hamas, and that Hamas was using them as human shields. So we go back and forth between, you know, the propaganda video and, you know, some very articulate people at the demonstration talking about why they're there, and try to counter some of that. You know, there's just so much of that we can do, but it's an important part of the story, you're right, Dick. And we just have to try to get the message out to be seen by as many people as we can. That's why the documentary is hopefully talks to an audience, not at an audience. And that's kind of what we want to try to get people.
Judy has her hand up.
Hello.
Judy's muted. She wants us to lip read.
I'm sorry.
Hello.
Hi. So this was, did you say this was all shot in 2015?
No, it's been shot from 2009 is when we started. And then we went back and there was shattered foot. And then there was quite a lot shot when I was there in 2015. But the media group, our partners inside Gaza, have been shooting pretty continuously from 2015 till yesterday. So the documentary, the final edit, will have footage from 2009 all the way till today.
So you follow the same families, the same stories, nine stories from 2009 to now. That's interesting. That sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of people who were really looking forward to taping who will be in the edit. There's one young girl who's part of the Ovid family who sings a little song. And she was about 12 years old when we taped that in 2010. So she's in her 20s now. And we're trying to find her to do an interview to update with her. But, you know, inshallah, all things considered, we want to try to do interviews with at least five or six people, not long interviews, but short interviews, bringing the story up till literally today. Because we will see a lot of these people over time.
Are they all still alive?
We're all still alive, except for, as I mentioned, Mohammed, the father of the young girl, who passed away of cancer. And he passed away about a year ago with cancer.
Okay, thank you. So
everyone else is still alive, and they're still getting out as best they can.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then I'm going to remind people about a few things. One is the current version of the film, We All Live in Gaza, is on Vimeo, and I distributed the link to it a few days ago. And if you can't find it, just write me and I'll distribute it again. That's number one. Number two is we encourage people to pay some dues if you're interested, because we use the dues to give honorarium to our speakers, which I already sent the honorarium this afternoon.
Thank you. I didn't even realize. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And number three, I want to remind you that in 2 weeks we have the film The Present, which was an Academy Award contender, and a video message from the filmmaker. And 2 weeks beyond that, we have Sami Smuha, who's a retired sociologist from the University of Haifa, talking about Jewish and Palestinian identities in Israel.
No, there's another speaker. We're still working on the date. That's Jeff Halper, who has a very interesting new piece in Manda Weiss on the relationships between Israel and the diaspora, something he's never written about before. And this essay has gotten a lot of attention. So we're waiting to work out a time with him. We don't have the date yet.
Yeah, that would be really good, especially after Sami Smuha, because Sami Smuha will talk about the identity of Jews in Israel, and Jeff Halper.
Palestinians. He's a real specialist in how Palestinian identity, both within Israel and the occupied territories, has changed.
And Jeff is going to talk about basically the Jewish identity of Jews in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so
I think this is one last thing. I want to leave you guys with, I'm going to put on the screen links to the project's three websites. And on these sites, you can follow the art project or the progress of the documentary. So I just want to...
It'd be better to put them on the chat.
Oh, okay. I can do that. But I was just going to do this really quickly. But it's... they're right here down at the bottom of the screen. It's art under siege.com, we/Gaza.com or studioresolution.net. And those are the three, but I'll put it on the chat as well. And anybody who wants to follow the project, if you go to any one of those websites, if you're especially interested in the art, there's a lot of the artwork displayed on the artundersiege.com. So I just wanted to let you know that there is a way to stay in touch with the project.
Well, put them on the chat before we end this, because that ends the chat.
Okay, so let me do that right now. Type message here, okay. I will put websites. Okay, so what we have here is www.we/Gaza.com.
Cut and paste them.
The other one, www.artundersiege.com. And then the last one is, and Studio Resolution is the website we just launched, which is kind of talking about all the interrelated projects and how they kind of all interconnect, and how hopefully as the project rolls out, it won't take us, I hope it won't take us 10 years to distribute it the way it took us 10 years to make the thing. But Studio Resolution kind of shows how the art and the documentary and the website are all kind of a symbiotic. So that's, kind of what we're trying to do. So if anybody wants to cut and paste that, I guess they can. Any other questions anybody has, or anything that I could answer, or suggestion? I mean, I'm open for suggestions too, from anybody.
Okay, if you put that in the chat, I'm gonna call this over.
Yeah, okay, it's in the chat, right?
It's not in there yet.
Oh, I thought I put it in. I typed the message here.
Hit enter.
I thought I did. There, I can see it on mine.
Who is it to?
It's in the chat room, direct chat, direct message. Oh, to all, I think. Oh, to everyone, I'm sorry. Is it? Can you see it now?
Nope.
I'm sorry. I thought that it was there. I can see it. I'm sorry, but if anybody, I think my email is on one of your emails. You can just
why not send it to me, Maurice, and when I put out the link to the recording, I'll put them on that, and I'll put that out in 2 hours. So send it to me right away.
Yeah, I'll do it right away. I'm sorry, this didn't go on. Sorry.
Okay. With that, I thank you, Maurice, and we learned a lot. And
Jeff.
Yeah.
I tried to pay you on Venmo, and I mistake, and it didn't go through. But then it did go through anyway. I paid you twice. Could you send me back the second payment, please?
Yes.
Okay, you'll see. Okay, sorry. Okay, didn't wrap.
Thank you for your help.
Okay, bye bye, everybody.
Okay, thank you. Take care. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your interest and your help along the way.